pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning
with the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading excerpts from When Chapel Hill Was a Village by Cornelia Spencer Love, published in 1976 by the Chapel Hill Historical Society. Continuing with the chapter, The University Library. The Klutz Parlor, with its cozy open fire, was quite a gathering place for town notables. Vernon Howell would come with some tale, perhaps the escapades of his nephew, Kike Kaiser. Doc's niece, Mrs. F. E. Conan, writes me that these were told with dry wit, long straight face, unsmiling, while his listeners rocked with laughter, as if he couldn't understand why anyone would think what he had said was funny. Or Dr. Abernethy would recount his European experiences in World War I, his first and last escape from home, where he had the time of his life. While he was overseas, someone asked his wife about him. Mrs. Abernethy wound up with a high sob, "He's living in a castle!" One dusky evening, Mrs. Klutz sped out to the garden to pick a head of lettuce for a visitor. Alas, she stepped into a hole and twisted her ankle. Dr. Mangum, across the street, was immediately summoned, and as she lay on the couch, he took hold of that foot and, by main strength, pulled it back into place. The pain must have been excruciating, but never a moan did Mrs. Klutz utter. Dr. Klutz guided his 1912 car with a rough hand. In those days, the roads were rough, too, but I never heard of his having an accident. Again, I quote Mrs. Conan. He did have a few. One day, when entering the narrow alley in Durham which led to the Cadillac garage, he bent a fender on the corner of a brick building. When Mrs. Klutz asked how he could have run into a building, he said, "I blew my horn, but it didn't move." Once again in Durham, on a street where farmers had parked a row of wagons, shaft to shaft, while their horses were accommodated in a shady lot, Doc, trying to park his car, ran into the hindmost. The wagons were shoved forward, breaking shafts, etc. Doc paid for all the repairs, which amounted to a sizable sum. 10 wagons were parked there. Only the 10th escaped some claimed injury. After paying for the damages, Doc said, "Well, I hit 9 out of 10. That's pretty good for one shot." Mrs. Klutz would be graded highly as a backseat driver, but Doc drove right on, irregardless. It was told that when he was driving up in the mountains by the Swannanoa River, he raised both hands on high and saluted, "Swannanoa, nymph of beauty." Mrs. Klutz, "You put those hands right back on the wheel," or... sorry, I forget her dire threat. I was taken on many rides, one of which turned out sadly. It was to be a picnic lunch at Pinehurst. We arrived, chose our lunch spot. "Now," said Mrs. K., "give me the lunch basket." Alas, it had been left in the Klutz kitchen. Yes, those 20s in the Klutz home in Chapel Hill were happy years, where we did not miss the inventions which have deluged us since. Olim Miminisse Uwabit. Mr. and Mrs. Horace Williams. They lived in the Beehive House, now belonging to the university, and I knew them because Horace and my parents were old friends, dating back to his first years of teaching at Chapel Hill. When my mother's body was brought back to Chapel Hill for burial in 1920, Mr. Williams helped my father with the arrangements, and asked some of his students to act as pallbearers. Two of them were Albert Coates and Thomas Wolfe. The Williamses were always very kind to me, but I found that he had a Jekyll and Hyde reputation. His students looked up to him as a great teacher of philosophy, asking searching questions that put their minds to work and made them think. People who had business deals with him in land or cattle said he was out to do them, would not only drive a hard bargain, but even a shady one. His wife, Bertha, was an artist from Connecticut, perhaps a good one, but I saw little of her work. She would say, "I started to paint Mrs. Whitehead, but didn't like it, so turned her into a snowstorm." She was indeed quite peculiar, and I never could decide whether it was congenital or brought on by life with Horace. He was stingy, and she would tell me stories that seemed to show up this quality, and yet tell them with an air of pride, as if it were to his credit. For instance, the story of their bathroom. There was no running water in Chapel Hill when they first came there, but later the town laid down pipes, and each homeowner was assessed for his share in the cost. But Horace Williams said he didn't ask for the pipes, and refused to pay. They continued to lug water from a spring in a hollow between their house and the Umsteads, which was called the Roaring Fountain, a pretty name, except that it wasn't a fountain, and didn't roar. Said Mrs. Williams to me, "I decided to do my own cooking and use the servants' pay for as long as it took to pay the town." She was proud of what she had done, but said no word of rebuke for her husband. The Carolina Playmakers. Somewhere Edwin Greenlaw, the distinguished head of the Department of English, encountered Frederick H. Coke and brought this one-man drama school to Chapel Hill, where he became known as Prof, and founded the Carolina Playmakers. He was a graduate of Harvard, where he had studied under Professor George Pierce Baker in his famous 47 workshop, going thence to the University of North Dakota, where the Dakota Playmakers were born. He was a little man in a Norfolk jacket, an innovator, a dynamo, whose outstanding characteristic was abounding enthusiasm. Young and old, students and faculty came under his spell and became his disciples. The idea behind his first classes was to get these unsophisticated young folks from the coast, Piedmont, and mountains to writing one-act plays about something that came within their ken, the folklore and lifestyle of the region whence they came. The students got the idea and looked up every unusual character in North Carolina, from the Nag's Head Pirates to the Mountain Outlaws and Bootleggers. They wrote good plays, acted them with spirit, and in time put them on the road to give performances in neighboring states. One of Prof's first actions was to corral all the dramatic talent in Chapel Hill and put it to work. He had on his committees Archibald Henderson, world-famed as the biographer and friend of Bernard Shaw, George McKee, teacher of elocution and no mean actor, Mrs. S. E. Levitt, a product of the Emerson School of Oratory in Boston, and many others. Townspeople were glad to lend their furniture and clothes, and then to buy season tickets to the plays. The high school auditorium provided the first stage. Later, they were allowed to use the Library Law School ballroom that was really Smith Hall, the most beautiful building on the campus, which is now known as the Playmakers' Theater. I was brought into the Coke orbit because in the Idler Club at Radcliffe, I had had dramatic experience, ranging from putting on makeup to acting the part of an old man in a chorus, and it was my good luck to be on a committee which was hearing auditions for Thomas Wolfe's first play, The Return of Buck Gavin. Tom, a tall, rangy, black-haired youth, first read the play to us, and then the would-be actors tried out for the part of Buck, the mountain outlaw, but none of them seemed to be right, and finally Prof said, "Tom, you must take the part. You are Buck Gavin." I was given the job of assembling props, and it was all such fun. Prof had no idea of time, and it might be late at night before a rehearsal was over and I could collect my props. One of them was a drink of something, which Tom had to quaff at a gulp. He came up to me beforehand and said, "Be sure that it tastes good." That was my sole communication with our future famous Thomas Wolfe. There were other gifted students who got their first writing experience in the Coke classes. Paul Green, Jonathan Daniels, George Denny, later the founder of the Town Hall in New York, Fanny Gray Patton. I could go on and on. There were good actors, too. Elizabeth Taylor as a down-at-heel mountain woman. Mary Yellett, the pretty farmer's daughter in Wilbert Stout's In Dixon's Kitchen. Hubert Hefner. Actors of previous experience were also attracted to the Playmaker boards. Lillian Prince, wife of William Meade Prince, whose drawing and writing talents were combined in his book about his childhood in Chapel Hill in 1900 to 1910, The Southern Part of Heaven, and Josephine Sharkey, a fine character actor. The Playmaker organization inspired other offbeat plays. Professor Howard Mumford Jones put on and coached an ancient sob drama called Thorns and Orange Blossoms. Then there was a performance of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, which must have been very funny, but I was no judge, because I was in it as Lady Bracknell, as was Dugald MacMillan, just returned from graduate study in England. He and I attempted a tony English accent, while the Southern students who took the other parts used whatever drawl they were born with. Susan Glaspell's amusing satire, Suppressed Desires, was also performed, with Hubert Hefner and me as the married couple, and Adeline Denham, later Mrs. F.B. McCall, as the put-upon sister. But the crowning achievements of Prof. Koch lay in the going out of so many of his students to all parts of the United States, teaching his methods of playwriting, and forming groups of enthusiastic young actors. Sometimes the playmakers were sniffed at by their fellow collegians, and said to give themselves airs. But isn't this treatment often accorded to purveyors of the arts? Mrs. Gore and Mrs. Marriott. These were two elderly widowed sisters living in a large house furnished with antiques, floor-length mirrors, really a colonial setup, which exactly suited the ladies, whose dress and manner of living was more suitable to the previous century than the 20th. Mrs. Marriott had a grown son, and had lived elsewhere during her marriage, so there was a bit more of a cosmopolitan air about her, but Mrs. Gore had come straight from her papa and mamma in Baltimore. She was extreme gentility to the nth degree. Sometimes she would tell me stories of her youth. A young man was coming to call on her, about whom her mother knew little, so she arranged a screen in the parlor behind which she could sit, listening to the conversation. And Mrs. Gore, in telling me about it, fully approved of the procedure. Occasionally her parents took them to Orkney Springs, a Virginia spa, where the head waiter would hasten to conduct them to their seats, in full recognition of what was due them. As the wife of Professor Joshua Gore, Mrs. Gore had been a notable hostess, serving a special kind of meringue dessert, the recipe of which she never would divulge, but when I knew her, she would invite me to afternoon tea, served in a pretty little room furnished in the Chinese fashion, with delicate china and a handsome silver service, delicious tea in a silver ball, with cream or lemon, and fragile sandwiches. Mrs. Gore had at her disposal a horse, buggy, and coachman, and every Sunday the two ladies would drive out to a small chapel in the country and conduct a Sunday school. It was Mrs. Gore's chapel, and had been going on for years. I never heard her say but one thing that was not right out of Emily Post. She was describing a young girl who lived next door, bending over to pick some flowers. "And," said Mrs. Gore, in great indignation, "I could see her cushions." In earlier days I was told there had been a great feud between Mrs. Gore and Mrs. Hume, wife of the English professor. They never spoke to each other, and it was tacitly understood that one went to a party early, the other late, to avoid embarrassing encounters. It was hinted that this feud was chiefly kept alive by Mrs. Gore, and no one seemed to know the origin of the falling out. Boarding houses and Southern food. Mrs. Klutz's and Mrs. Bain's have already been described, patronized chiefly by faculty and university employees in the eastern part of town. Mrs. Della Battle had several tables in the Battle home for a brief time. When a patron complained to her about the food, she said, "What do you expect in a cheap boarding house?" Mrs. Thornton, the mother of a young instructor, kept house for Professor Hickerson in his new home on Battle Lane, which included, for meals, a few of his colleagues. She was a compulsive talker, whose tongue was never still. Hick Hobbs, a wily young mathematician, told me that he had looked her case up in a medical book, and found there was such a disease in which a person said aloud everything that came into her head. I say her head because I've known of three such cases, and they were all women. A Mrs. Thomas took in boarders for some time in what was later Nellie Robertson's house, two doors beyond Vernon Howell's on Franklin Street. For some weeks Mrs. Klutz closed down, owing to Doc's illness, so we moved across the street to Mrs. Thomas. At my table sat Dr. and Mrs. Mangum, Dr. Bernard, Mrs. Turlington, and her son Edgar, and two pretty co-eds. We were a jolly group, socially speaking, but I can't say much for the food. Brains and eggs was a favorite luncheon dish, but Dr. Mangum would come in from his classroom and say he had been teaching brains all the morning and just could not eat them, too. The best dish was molded corn sticks. Mrs. Turlington was a brilliant woman, formerly a teacher, so highly keyed that she told me any alcoholic drink would be poison for her, that even a glass of water could make her high. Her son Edgar was slightly deaf, and on one occasion, when Dr. Bernard had been arguing with him, the doctor muttered a retort which he knew Edgar could not hear. This made his mother mad. She had just reached for a biscuit, and suddenly threw it in Dr. Bernard's direction. I don't know which of the two was the more surprised. One day the whole dining room was agog over the story of a newcomer in town, a Mrs. Cushman with an instructor's son in tow, who had been inspecting Mrs. Bain's rooms for rent, remarking in each, "It's duddy, it's duddy." This story greatly amused Lucius McGee, highly respected dean of the law school, who sat at the head of the other table. He chuckled and chuckled over the gossip, and even remarked, "I would just like to see her." At dinner that night, whom did he find sitting on his right but the redoubtable Mrs. Cushman? Memory draws a curtain. Mrs. Blanche Patterson was persuaded by some of the bachelor faculty to give meals just for them. She was a noted housekeeper, able to take some ordinary ground-up beef and do so many things to it that the resulting dish was simply delicious. For some reason, these favored gentlemen were known as the Old Soldiers, and they included Major Kane, Vernon Howell, Frank Graham, Grover Beard, and others. Mrs. Patterson's home was the present Lambda Chi Alpha house. She could even provide the rare and forbidden delicacy, birds, as quail were then known. They could only be hunted in a limited season, and never sold. But if you knew somebody who knew somebody, well, it could come to pass. One of my remembered disappointments is sitting down at a friend's table, four in all, with a bird apiece. In comes uninvited Vernon Howell, and the hostess had to remove our plates and make five helpings of the delicacy out of four. Other specialty dishes served by Chapel Hill hostesses were persimmon pudding, sweet potato biscuits, barbecued chicken, Sally Lunn bread, lemon chess pie, chicken spaghetti, two varieties, and Brunswick stew, which could vary greatly in ingredients, from a chopped-up meat of rabbit to chicken, pork, or a mixture of these, with a mélange of corn, beans, tomatoes, sometimes mashed potatoes if you wanted it thickened. Made by a good cook, it was both delicious and filling, and needed only cornbread to provide a hearty meal. And biscuits! There were two kinds, the beaten and the hot. The first were beaten many times, preferably with a stick on a sturdy tree stump, and when cooked resembled a thick cracker which could be split in two and eaten with soup, salad, or a spread, and would keep indefinitely in a tin box. Mrs. Julia Graves, Lewis's mother, was noted for her beaten biscuits, and disdained any modern contraption which would do the beating. But hot biscuits, oh, they were daily fare, made from scratch long before the canned variety was ever invented. I have always maintained that the surest way to win a man's heart would be to invite him to a tasty meal, accompanied by an abundance of hot biscuits, with the urging, "Take two, and butter 'em while they're hot." Vernon Howell. The first dean of the School of Pharmacy, E. V. Howell, built well and founded an excellent school which sent pharmacists all over the South. A later dean, E. A. Brecht, told me that he enjoyed going into drug stores in North Carolina, talking to the pharmacist, and, in most cases, finding that he'd received his training at Chapel Hill. Vernon Howell knew his subject thoroughly, but in many ways he was a peculiar old bachelor, with very poor eyesight, which tended to encourage his festive, party-giving avocations. He lived in the old house now owned by his famous nephew Kay, formerly known as Kike, Kaiser, and loved to give parties attended by a few select friends. They were usually barbecue parties in his backyard, carried out by his able lieutenant, Foy Baker. Let me explain that a barbecue meant the slow roasting of a young pig, turned for hours over a fire of wood chips dug deep in the ground, and anointed from time to time by a hot or mild sauce, according to the host's tastes. When thoroughly cooked, the pig was taken out, gristle and bones removed, and cut into small pieces to be served with cornbread or hush puppies, slaw, and more sauce, as desired. Corn liquor flowed freely, and it was a great privilege to be invited to one of Mr. Howell's parties. He held one in New York for vacationing friends to attend the hit show Irene. After dining, they assembled at the theater. He asked for his tickets at the box office, only to discover that somewhere a mistake had been made. The theater was showing his tickets admitted them to a Shakespeare play. He told this story on himself, and here's another one. Having heard how Parisians talk, he was trying to pronounce a French word, and to give it the proper nasal twang, he pinched his nostrils together with his fingers, having overlong nails, thus breaking the skin. Henceforth, he delighted in showing how he had bled for France. He visited French bookstores, acquiring bargains in rare pharmaceutical volumes, which he knew about, but in venturing into the subject of champignons, he was carried away by old dates and crumbly leather bindings, and bought books for the botany department, which his friend W. C. Coker was not overjoyed to see. He was also a collector of various items. One, yes, this is true, was baby caps. He also had a small cold closet from the ceiling of which hung dark, dried-up pieces of ham, which were supposed to mellow into delicious morsels. I never knew anyone who was treated to one of these repulsive-looking scraps, so cannot tell you what they tasted like. Every now and then Mr. Howell would pick up an ancient pamphlet, from whence I do not know, and boast of its rarity. In one, he said, it told that an ancestor of Archibald Henderson, of notable pedigree, had been a midwife. Nephew K. Kaiser added to the house and grounds, and made it into a charming show place. The Cocktail Hour. The advent of Prohibition certainly opened the way for ladies to partake of hard liquor, and for men to indulge in more of it. Good whiskey had always been rare enough, with none available in the state unless smuggled in, or given by a generous M.D. The mountaineers had their stills, and corn liquor could be bought by those who knew the ropes. In time, women acquired a taste for it, too, and it became customary in many circles to serve cocktails before a dinner party, and sometimes continue the drinking afterward. The best-tasting contraband was kept in a charred barrel for a certain length of time. The worst, well, it was pretty awful. Twice it made me sick, at highly respected homes. It was fatal to try and fancy it up with fruit juice. Plain branch water was the only endurable mixer. People tried home brews, too. For beer, you could buy yeast and a malt mixture, and let it mature with water in a brown jar. It didn't taste very good, but one bottle was potent. Felix Hickerson was noted for his dandelion wine. Nell Booker learned how to make a very drinkable wine out of rice. Or you could order corn liquor by the gallon from a respectable man living between Chapel Hill and Durham. The method of ordering was intriguing. Each customer had a personal number and would send him a postcard bearing this number, the figure 2, and a date. This meant that 2 gallons were wanted on that day, when it would be duly brought to the customer's back door, where the regular price would be paid. I've forgotten what it cost. No more than $4 a gallon. Dinner parties could be very uproarious. Occasionally, Mrs. Klutz would give a special stag dinner for a bachelor professor, and once or twice I was invited. I will never forget a history professor, next to me at the dining table, telling me about a charming woman whom he had met on shipboard. "If anything should ever happen to my wife," he said, "I know exactly where I would go." This man's wife would allow nothing alcoholic in her house, and if any was found, she promptly poured it down the drain. A kindly widow living across the way allowed him to keep a bottle in her house for occasional nips. Sometimes, for an afternoon party, the punch would be spiked. Later on, good liquor could be bought in Danville, Virginia. It was illegal to bring it into North Carolina, but you were not apt to be caught. At one party, Mrs. W., a strict Methodist, drank several cups, remarking on the delicious punch. She seemed to get away with it, but later her husband phoned the hostess to ask what she had served his wife. One time Dr. C. came into possession of a pint of good whiskey and took it to a friend's house, thinking they would enjoy it together. "Oh, thank you so much," said Dr. H., and proceeded to put it away in a cupboard. Another time a widowed professor gave an afternoon party in 2 sections, the non-imbibers for the first hour, the partakers for the second. Unwittingly, Frank Graham, who was so pure that he did not even know what liquor smelled like, arrived when the second party was in full swing. The host, who was by now thoroughly enjoying himself, greeted him with a big hug. Later, a still innocent, greatly pleased Frank remarked to a friend, "I thought that Dwight was fond of me, but I didn't know he was that fond." We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.